So this session is being moderated by Jessica Lundquist from the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and here she is.
All right, so we're starting these 5 minutes late, so we're going to be running each one 5 minutes late. That will shorten your lunch by 5 minutes, but please forgive us. Our first speaker is Dennis Lettenmeyer, who is a professor of civil and environmental engineering here, and he'll be talking about Washington's water resources in a changing climate. Thank you, Dennis.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jessica. And I want to, at the outset, say that this presentation is on behalf of a whole team of people who have recently completed a climate change impact study of the state of Washington. In fact, some of you were probably downtown at the convention center last week for an open public meeting on this. And I'm not going to attempt to go list all the people who have been involved in this. I will say that I am delivering the message on behalf of them. I've used many visuals in particular, however, from Marquetta McGuire and Julie Vano, and thanks to them is particularly in order. So the Washington State Climate Change Impacts Assessment, the previous session of the Washington State Legislature, back when the state still had money, passed a bill, mandated the preparation of comprehensive assessment, and asked that the UW Climate Impacts Group do it. It was to be focused on the impacts of global warming generally, specifically in relationship to eight areas. In addition to there were sort of some supporting areas like regional climate modeling. The interesting thing is I'll be talking about the water-related aspects of it here, and there are at least four of the eight areas, and arguably two more, that are directly related to water. Infrastructure, and I'm not going to say very much about that, specifically stormwater, because Eric Rosenberg will follow with a talk dealing with that directly. Water supply and management, and I should indicate here that we partner with Pacific Northwest National Labs on some of the work in the Yakima River system. That's mostly the water supply management hydrology issues I'll be talking about here. Salmon and ecosystems, and particularly habitat, physical condition of rivers and so on, stream temperature, low flows, and then energy. In the region, much of the energy comes from hydropower, so there's a direct linkage with water there as well. So one of the major aspects of this study that we pushed was to link it as closely as possible to the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change results. And by now, many global climate models have archived their output from the IPCC 2007 study. Lawrence Livermore Labs has an archive. We were able to use some 20 of these models for which there have been consistent global emission scenarios, and that's what these SRES B1 and SRES A1B businesses is about. I probably have these visuals in reverse order, and let's flip the temperature, which is the one people usually see. And the one thing you see, and you can go read the reports on what assumptions are in there about global economic growth, about mitigation of CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions and so on. The short version is that over about the next 30 years or so, both the emissions and the implications in terms of temperature rise, and this is actually regionally averaged over some area, aren't too much different. Then they start to diverge a bit, and B1 is a somewhat more optimistic scenario than A1B, and we ran both of these. The state was actually particularly interested in what the outlook was sort of in the 2020s or so. What are the relatively near-term issues? But we ran out to the 2040s and 2080s as well, and there will be results shown for both. So temperature goes up, basically, in all the models. The question is how much. Precipitation, there's a pretty wide range. When you average across all of these things, very slight increase in precipitation. There is also a slight, on average, increase in winter and decrease in summer. But whether or not that's sufficient for a consensus is somewhat open to question. Okay, the study region, well, the state was obviously interested in the state of Washington, but water doesn't respect political boundaries. So What we did was that we looked at the Columbia River Basin, and some issues like hydropower need to deal with the Columbia River Basin. We also looked at a couple of river basins. One, river basins that feed water supply systems in western Washington, I'll be talking about in a little more detail, and then the Yakima River Basin in the east I'll also be talking about. Okay. One, from a hydrologic standpoint, one of the important characteristics of rivers in the state of Washington is the implications of snow accumulation in the winter, spring and summer melt. And that varies depending on where you are, and you can talk about, you know, sort of rain dominant, snow dominant, and transition watersheds. And these are important for a number of purposes in the current climate. But rain dominant clearly is the lowlands. Transient ends up being a good bit of low elevation eastern Washington and sort of the lower kind of foothills of the Cascades. And then snow dominant is most of the core of the Cascades. And this is just one way. It's basically the ratio of the peak snow water equivalent to total winter precipitation. You can partition this in different ways, but you get a picture that looks something like that. That's in the current climate. Okay, how do you do an impacts assessment? Well, the information you have on projections comes from global models. They're at large scales, typically 3 degrees or so latitude by longitude, very roughly 300 kilometers or so. Just a very small number of those, 3 or 4 of those grid cells fit over the whole state, and they don't really even know about the Cascade Mountains, so you have to do something to downscale. And there's a whole literature on how to do this that I certainly don't have time to go into here. We did what is termed statistical downscaling for the most part, although there are also some regional climate modeling involved. Eric will talk a bit about that in the next talk. But at some point, you get down to hydrologic models, which take as inputs the climate variables downscaled to the appropriate scale, and then allow us to look at the hydrology. And from that, then these various sectors, water management, the one we'll be mostly talking about, but also these others, energy, I won't talk about forests, infrastructure, Eric will talk about, irrigated ag a little bit, and salmon and fisheries more general. Couple of models, again, I don't have time to go into details of these at all, but these are both physically based models that take forcings and deal with both the water budget at the land surface and the energy budget. The difference between the two of them, DHSVM, Distributed Hydrology Soil Vegetation Model, is that it's a high resolution model, runs at sort of 100 or so meter resolution. VIC, in our case, was run at 1/16th degree spatial resolution. That's very roughly 5 or 6 kilometers. So this model is kind of appropriate to bigger areas. This one's appropriate to smaller areas. The west side water supply systems mostly are fairly small watersheds. We use DHSVM. The Yakima Basin is somewhat larger. We use this model there. Climate change projections, again, this is all to do with downscaling. We used a very simple downscaling method, and what it consists of is just saying, look, we have some historical record of precipitation and temperature actually gridded over the state, and we have this information daily going back to 1916. We simply, for the future climate, create perpetual future climates equivalent to what the models say for the 2020s, 2040s, and 2080s. Okay, so we basically just shift on a monthly basis precipitation and temperature. There are other ways of doing this. Frankly, you'll get about the same answer in terms of the management impacts. Okay, focus watersheds. I mentioned before within the Puget Sound Basin, the river basins that feed the major water supply system, the green for the city of Tacoma, Cedar and Tolt for the Seattle system, and part of the Snohomish, actually the Salton River for the city of Everett, and then the Yakima Basin, we're looking at it in its entirety from the standpoint of agriculture. And I should point out the major issues on the west side for these basins are municipal and industrial water supply, and for the Yakima Basin, it's ag. Okay. How much time do I actually have? Okay, oh, that's a one. You just held up. So 1 minute, I can't be at 1 minute. Okay, nonetheless, I need to go pick up the pace here. Not surprisingly different from other studies, when you look at the implications for snow across the state, it goes down, 2020s, 29%, 27%. Turns out that if you do some back-of-the-envelope calculations, Joe Casola in Atmospheric Sciences has written a very nice paper looking at sensitivities of snowpack in the Cascades to changing climate in different ways. He gets something in the low 20s percent change per degree C. These changes turn out to correspond to something order of 1.2, 1.3 degrees C. When you divide it out, I get something like 24% per degree C average across these. They're not too far different from what Joe got. When you look at the Cedar River, which is the City of Seattle water supply, and then the Yakima River, the percentage changes are bigger. And the reason is those are lower elevation, transient basins, so they've got more of their snow in this sort of highly sensitive zone. The sensitivities are a bit higher. I'm going to go past this, and I'm going to talk just very briefly of the character of these changes. Talked about rain-dominant watersheds. You go change the climate. Doesn't make much difference to a rain-dominant watershed. There's some effect on evapotranspiration in the summer, but it's actually fairly minor. These transient watersheds have got these major shifts. These different lines are 2020s, 2040s, 2080s, and you see these kind of transitions. This is for the Yakima River, from basically a snow-dominant watershed with a little bump in the winter to something that's eventually almost all winter dominant. You look at the Yakima or the Columbia Basin as a whole, turns out that the shift isn't very big in comparison, and the reason is a lot of that runoff comes from high elevation areas in BC, western slope of the Rockies, and so on. So there's this major difference in signature, and what kind of mix you have in your watersheds kind of determines the management issues. Okay, so this just sort of shows for the Cedar River watershed, the red is what you have now. And progressively, as you go to these different scenarios, the gray band actually turns out to be the range of the different climate projections for the 2020s. The black line in the middle of that is kind of the mean of those. And then these other lines are for a composite, which is basically the mean of the different scenarios in 2040s and 2080s. The bottom line is this thing shifts to a rain-dominant watershed from one that's pretty strongly mixed now. The Yakima is interesting because, like I said, it's got this little bump and then this big spring peak, and that transitions pretty strongly across. Okay, for the Puget Sound Basin, let me flip forward to the bottom line here for municipal water supply reliability. And it turns out that if you look, these bars are for the current climate and various future climates, 2020s, 2040s, 2080s. Same for Tacoma and same for Everett. There's not that much change. The reason these water supply systems have been quite effective in reducing their demand over the last decade or so. So their demand for water, not only on a per capita basis, but on a total basis, is actually considerably smaller than it was 10 years or so. So they basically created a buffer that allows them to withstand the changes in climate. Now, again, without going into a lot of details here, but if you look at the effects, the combined effects of climate and increasing demand, so this first one is increase the demand by 10%, increase it by 20%, increase it by 50%. These bars are the same, so current climate, 2020s, 2040s, and so now you start getting some signal in there. But even out into the 2020s, they're in general not too bad off in Seattle. They don't have a huge issue, mostly because of this buffer. Let me go forward to the Yakima River Basin, which is an interesting case. That basin is actually over-allocated, and there are junior and senior water rights users. It turns out that the junior water rights users do not get all of their water, even under the present climate. And what you see is this is the unregulated flow. This is the regulated flow. If you look at this carefully and look at the red line, the regulated flow in the current climate, what they do is flatten out the natural peak in the hydrograph. that becomes increasingly hard to do as you get the shift to wintertime run up because you don't have enough storage. I mean, that's basically a short story there. And if you now go look at the performance of the system in terms of the amount of prorating, okay, 0 to 1.0 means that everybody gets, and this is particularly for the junior users, they get all their water. 0.75, which is where this line is, means they get a 75 or 25% reduction. So they get 75% of the nominal allocation. In general, there are things they can do, and a lot of this is, it turns out to be orchards and so on, to shuffle water around, wells, other things like that. But when they get less than this, they basically have trouble. So you look at this line for the red, it turns out in the current climate, I think the number it may show up here is, 14% is this number here. That goes to 32% in the 2020s, and there's some range, 15 to 54 across the climate scenarios, 36 and 77. They got a major problem over there. And, you know, when you give an orchard substantially less water than it needs, eventually you kill the trees, and it's not a good thing, so it's not just 1 year. We looked in conjunction with the group at Claudia Stockel's group at Washington State University at the impacts on various crops. Turns out there's a bunch of things go on here. The amount of water available is just one of them. There's CO2 fertilization issues. There's some other things, temperature-sensitive effects. I don't think I'll go into details, but in general, it's problematic, not too much for the senior irrigators who are basically okay, but for the junior irrigators, they end up taking a hit. Okay, just briefly touch on a couple of other areas. One is energy. Turns out that what happens is that as the flow of the Columbia starts to occur earlier, the hydropower production, not surprisingly, occurs earlier as well. These plots here are for heating degree days and cooling degree days. And the interesting thing is that different lines have population increases and just the base current population. Under the current population, not too surprisingly, the heating degree day requirement actually starts going down. It gets warmer. You don't need as much heat, which is good. Cooling degree days all go up. If you can look closely at these axes, which you probably can't see, there's a ratio of about 6 or so on here. So even in the warmer climate, the cooling has not gotten up close to what the heating requirements are. So there's kind of a mix in what goes on there. There's a bit of a tug of war. Erica is going to talk about the effects on precipitation intensity and infrastructure in the next talk, so I'll go by that. Issues for fish have to do with several things. One, more winter flooding because more rain, less snow, particularly in these low elevation basin. Lower summer flows are a problem as you get that seasonal shift. Warmer stream temperatures are an issue, so all of these things are kind of fighting against each other. So let me conclude with just a few comments here. First, there's a broad consensus amongst the IPCC models that Pacific Northwest temperatures will rise. That's not a surprise. That's gone back for, you know, at least 20 years or so. They'll continue and amplify 20th century trends, which have been of the order in the Pacific Northwest, half a degree to a degree C or so. Precipitation changes are less clear, both historically and projected. Some indication of slightly wetter conditions, especially in winter. Dominant hydrologic signal is a reduction in snow water equivalent stream flow timing shifts. Direct effects on the Western Washington water supply system are nonetheless modest, mostly because of this reduction in demand over the last couple of decades. Impacts on the already over-allocated Yakima Basin are of greater concern, and other water-related sectors, fish habitat, energy, infrastructure, are generally negatively impacted, although the specifics vary. And I will point out that there is a report that consists of an executive summary and detailed reports on each of these areas, and if you send me an email, I can refer you to those reports if you want more detail. Thanks. Where's Cliff Mass? Where are the guys who've been sending all these emails? Wow. Oh, I got somebody in the back.
Your fourth bullet down about water supply in Western Washington, is that that based upon assumptions extrapolated from the Department of City of Seattle's Delta Conservation extended throughout the Sonoma, or is that based upon other demanded yields?
Yeah. We looked at three. Okay, let me. Yeah, thank you, Jessica. Repeat the question. The question, I believe, had to do with, did we extrapolate the experience of the city of Seattle to the rest of the Puget Sound Basin, or where did I get that conclusion? So the study included water supply modeling of the three major water supply systems in Western Washington: Tacoma's, Seattle's, and Everett's. And it actually turns out that this demand reduction is something that's been observed in all three of them. Now, what we did was two things, and it turns out this is slightly different than some other studies, which apparently had somewhat conflicting results, but not really when we look at them, because we separated out the climate signal and the demand signal. So we looked at current demands and what the effect of climate would be. Then we added in the effects of demand growth. We did not project demand growth to specifically to particular decades, actually at the recommendations of the water supply systems, and said we just did sensitivity. We said, what if they increased by 10, 20, and 50%? But the analysis has been conducted for all of the systems. It turns out that for a variety of reasons, Tacoma is just slightly more sensitive than the other systems, and there's a whole bunch of differences I can't go into in the way the reservoir systems are operated, but all of them have a bit of this buffer because of demand reductions over the last decade or two, and that's what's helping them out.
Can you just clarify what the demand reductions are?
How they came about?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question is, what are the demand reductions? And, you know, if there's anybody here from Seattle Public Utilities or whatever, they can probably correct me. But, you know, what has happened is there have been a few substantial droughts, okay, over the last couple of decades. Turns out the post-1977 period was pretty dry. There was a major drought in 1987. There's another one in 92. I think 92 is the only one where there are mandatory water restrictions in the city of Seattle. There are a couple of others in there. And as a result of that, they really got on top of things and encouraged reduction in demand. And a lot of the demand for which the system actually ends up being sized is irrigation, residential irrigation, lawns and stuff like that. And people tend to overwater lawns. Frankly, you can't kill a lawn in Seattle. I mean, I don't bother to water my own because I don't particularly like mowing it. And the first time when it gets it rains in September, the thing is green anyway. But I think that message has gotten across. Lower water use appliances, in-house appliances, dishwashers, and this has been mandated by the federal government. That's all made a difference, and I think, but somebody could correct me if I'm wrong, that higher density housing has made a difference. A lot more people are living in condos, apartments, and stuff like that than your standard half-acre house with a huge sprawling lawn. But that definitely has been a major signature in demand. It's interesting, actually, that has happened nationally as well. It's not just the Pacific Northwest, and there's USGS reports on that.
Do you notice if the models are telling you anything about groundwater supplies as a result of climate change?
That is actually, okay, the issue has to do with groundwater and climate change. That's an area that has not been studied very much. I mean, I can say that flat out. And in Washington, there was one study that I'm aware of done by John Vaccaro down at the USGS in 1992 of the Ellensburg groundwater system. Groundwater recharge is a difference between two large numbers, so it's a complicated issue. A complicated issue to start with, but you know, if you got slight increases in precipitation and slight increases in evapotranspiration, there's some canceling effect there. And where the balance is, I'm not sure. I actually do know that we don't understand that yet, and it's a good topic for more study. I think do you want to take one more, or are we done? I'm sorry? We're done. Okay, thank you.